Thank you for your cooperation. And the screen said, Analyzer confirms identity, Hall, Mark. Please listen closely, said the mechanical voice. You will answer the following questions with a yes or no reply. Make no other response. Have you received a smallpox vaccination within the last 12 months? Yes. Diphtheria? Yes. Typhoid and paratyphoid A and B? Yes. Tetanus toxoid? Yes. Yellow fever? Yes, yes, yes. I had them all. Just answer the question, please. Uncooperative subjects waste valuable computer time. Yes, Hall said, subdued. When he had joined the wildfire team, he had undergone immunizations for everything imaginable, even plague and cholera, which had to be renewed every 6 months, and gamma globulin shots for viral infection. Have you ever contracted tuberculosis or other mycobacterial disease, or had a positive skin test for tuberculosis? No. Have you ever contracted syphilis or other spirochetal disease, or had a positive serological test for syphilis? No. Have you contracted within the past year any gram-positive bacterial infection, such as streptococcus, staphylococcus, or pneumococcus? No. Any gram-negative infection, such as gonococcus, meningococcus, proteus, pseudomonas, salmonella, or shigella? No. Have you contracted any recent or past fungal infection, including blastomycosis, histoplasmosis, or coccidiomycosis, or had a positive skin test for any fungal disease? No. Have you had any recent viral infection, including poliomyelitis, hepatitis, mononucleosis, mumps, measles, varicella, or herpes? No. Any warts? No. Have you any known allergies? Yes, to ragweed pollen. On the screen appeared the words, Rogween Pallin. And then after a moment, uncodable response. Please repeat your response slowly for our memory cells. Very distinctly, he said, ragweed pollen. On the screen, ragweed pollen coded. Are you allergic to albumin? Continued the voice. No. This ends the formal questions. Please undress and return to the couch, obliterating the points as before. He did so. A moment later, an ultraviolet lamp swung out on a long arm and moved close to his body. Next to the lamp was some kind of scanning eye. Watching the screen, he could see the computer print of the scan, beginning with his feet. This is a scan for fungus, the voice announced. After several minutes, Hall was ordered to lie on his stomach, and the process was repeated. He was then told to lie on his back once more and align himself with the dots. Physical parameters will now be measured, the voice said. You are requested to lie quietly while the examination is conducted. A variety of leads snaked out at him and were attached by mechanical hands to his body. Some he could understand. The half-dozen leads over his chest for an electrocardiogram, and 21 on his head for an electroencephalogram. But others were fixed on his stomach, his arms, and his legs. Please raise your left hand, said the voice. Paul did. From above, a mechanical hand came down, with an electric eye fixed on either side of it. The mechanical hand examined Hall's. Place your hand on the board to the left. Do not move. You will feel a slight prick as the intravenous needle is inserted. Hall looked over at the screen. It flashed a color image of his hand, with a vein showing in a pattern of green against a blue background. Obviously, the machine worked by sensing heat. He was about to protest when he felt a brief sting. He looked back. The needle was in. Now then, just lie quietly. Relax. For 15 seconds, The machinery whined and clattered. Then the leads were withdrawn. The mechanical hands placed a neat band-aid over the intravenous puncture.
"This completes your physical parameters," the voice said.
"Can I get dressed now?"
"Please sit up with your right shoulder facing the television screen. You will receive pneumatic injections."
A gun with a thick cable came out of one wall, pressed up against the skin of his shoulder, and fired. There was a hissing sound and a brief pain.
"Now you may dress," said the voice. "Be advised that you may feel dizzy for a few hours. You have received booster immunizations and gamma G. If you feel dizzy, sit down. If you suffer systemic effects such as nausea, vomiting, or fever, report at once to level control. Is that clear?"
"Yes."
"The exit is to your right. Thank you for your cooperation. This recording is now ended."
Hall walked with Levitt down a long, red corridor. His arm ached from the injection. "That machine," Hall said. "You better not let the AMA find out about it."
"We haven't," Levitt said.
In fact, the electronic body analyzer had been developed by Sandeman Industries in 1965, under a general government contract to produce body monitors for astronauts in space. It was understood by the government at that time that such a device, though expensive at a cost of $87,000 each, would eventually replace the human physician as a diagnostic instrument. The difficulties for both doctor and patient of adjusting to this new machine were recognized by everyone. The government did not plan to release the EBA until 1971, and then only to certain large hospital facilities. Walking along the corridor, Hall noticed that the walls were slightly curved.
"Where exactly are we?"
"On the perimeter of level one. To our left are all the laboratories. To the right is nothing but solid rock."
Several people were walking in the corridor. Everyone wore pink jumpsuits. They all seemed serious and busy.
"Where are the others on the team?" Hall said.
"Right here," Levitt said.
He opened a door marked Conference 7, and they entered a room with a large hardwood table. Stone was there, standing stiffly erect and alert, as if he had just taken a cold shower. Alongside him, Burton, the pathologist, somehow appeared sloppy and confused, and there was a kind of tired fright in his eyes. They all exchanged greetings and sat down. Stone reached into his pocket and removed two keys. One was silver, the other red. The red one had a chain attached to it. He gave it to Hall.
"Put it around your neck," he said.
Hall looked at it.
"What's this?"
Levitt said, "I'm afraid Mark is still unclear about the odd man."
"I thought that he would read it on the plane."
"His file was edited."
"I see." Stone turned to Hall. "You know nothing about the odd man?"
"Nothing,"
Hall said, frowning at the key. "Nobody told you that a major factor in your selection to the team was your single status?"
"What does that have to do?"
"The fact of the matter is," Stone said, "that you are the odd man. You are the key to all this. Quite literally."
He took his own key and walked to a corner of the room. He pushed a hidden button, and the wood paneling slid away to reveal a burnished metal console. He inserted his key into a lock and twisted it. A green light on the console flashed on. He stepped back. The paneling slid into place.
"At the lowest level of this laboratory is an automatic, atomic, self-destruct device," Stone said. "It is controlled from within the laboratory. I have just inserted my key and armed the mechanism. The device is ready for detonation. The key on this level cannot be removed. It is now locked in place. Your key, on the other hand, can be inserted and removed again. There is a 3-minute delay between the time detonation locks in and the time the bomb goes off. That period is to provide you time to think and perhaps call it all off.
Paul was still frowning. But why me?
Because you're single. We have to have one unmarried man.
Stone opened a briefcase and withdrew a file. He gave it to Hall.
Read that.
It was a wildfire file.
Page 255, Stone said.
Hall turned to it.
Project Wildfire. Alterations. 1. Millipore fitters. Insertion into ventilatory system. Initial spec filters unilayer styrolene with maximal efficiency of 97.4% trapping. Replaced in 1966 when Upjohn developed filters capable of trapping organisms of size up to 1 micron. Trapping at 90% efficiency per leaf, causing triple-layered membrane to give results of 99.9%. An effective ratio of 0.1%, remainder too low to be harmful. Cost factor of 4 or 5-layered membranes, removing all but 0.001%, considered prohibitive for added gain. Tolerance parameter of 1/1000, considered sufficient. Installation completed, 8/12/66. 2. Atomic self-destruct device. Change in detonator, close gap, timers. See AEC, DEF file, 77-12-0918. Atomic self-destruct device. Revision of core maintenance schedules for K technicians. See AEC, Warburg file, 77-14-0004. 4. Atomic self-destruct device. Final command decision change. See AEC, DEF file, 77-14-0023. Summary appended. Summary of odd man hypothesis. First tested as null hypothesis by Wildfire Advisory Committee. Grew out of tests conducted by USAF, NORAD, to determine reliability of commanders in making life-death decisions. Tests involve decisions in 10 scenario contexts, with pre-structured alternatives drawn up by Walter Reed Psychiatric Division after N-order test analysis by Biostatistics Unit, NIH, Bethesda. Tests given to SAC pilots and ground crews, NORAD workers, and others involved in decision-making or positive action capacity. 10 scenarios drawn up by Hudson Institute. Subjects required to make yes-no decision in each case. Decisions always involved thermonuclear or chembiol destruction of enemy targets. Data on 7,420 subjects tested by H1-H2 program for multifactorial analysis of variants. Later test by ANOVAR program. Final discrimination by CLASIF program. NIH Biostat summarizes this program as follows. It is the object of this program to determine the effectiveness of assigning individuals to distinct groups on the basis of scores which can be quantified. The program produces group contours and probability of classification for individuals as a control of data. Program prints mean scores for groups, contour confidence limits, and scores of individual test subjects. Signed, K.G. Borgrand, Ph.D., NIH. Results of odd man study. The study concluded that married individuals performed differently from single individuals on several parameters of the test. Hudson Institute provided mean answers, i.e., theoretical, right decisions, made by computer on basis of data given in scenario. Conformance of study groups to these right answers produced an index of effectiveness, a measure of the extent to which correct decisions were made. Married males, 0.343. Married females, 0.399. Single females, 0.402. Single males, 0.824. The data indicate that married men choose the correct decision only once in 3 times, while single men choose correctly 4 out of 5 times. The group of single males was then broken down further in search of highly accurate subgroups within that classification. Single males, total, 0.824. Military, commissioned officer, 0.655. Non-commissioned officer,
0.624. Technical. Engineers. 0.877. Ground crews. 0.901. Service. Maintenance and utility. 0.758. Professional. Scientists. 0.946. These results concerning the relative skill of decision-making individuals should not be interpreted hastily. Although it would appear that janitors are better decision-makers than generals, the situation is, in reality, more complex. Printed scores are summations of test and individual variations. Data must be interpreted with this in mind. Failure to do so may lead to totally erroneous and dangerous assumptions. Application of study to wildfire command personnel conducted at request of AEG at time of implantation of self-destruct nuclear capacity. Test given to all wildfire personnel. Results filed under CLASIF Wildfire General Personnel. See REF 77-14-0023. Special testing for command group. Burton, 0.543. Levitt, 0.601. Kirk, 0.614. Stone, 0.687. Hall, 0.899. Results of special testing confirm the odd man hypothesis that an unmarried male should carry out command decisions involving thermonuclear or chem-biol destruct contexts.
When Hall had finished reading, he said, "It's crazy."
"Nonetheless," Stone said, "it was the only way we could get the government to put control of the weapon in our hands."
"You really expect me to put in my key and fire that thing?"
"I'm afraid you don't understand," Stone said. "The detonation mechanism is automatic. Should breakthrough of the organism occur, with contamination of all level 5, detonation will take place within 3 minutes unless you lock in your key and call it off."
"Oh," Hall said, in a quiet voice.
11. Decontamination.
A bell rang somewhere on the level. Stone glanced up at the wall clock. It was late. He began the formal briefing, talking rapidly, pacing up and down the room, hands moving constantly.
"As you know," he said, "we are on the top level of a 5-story underground structure. According to protocol, it will take us nearly 24 hours to descend through the sterilization and decontamination procedures to the lowest level. Therefore, we must begin immediately. The capsule is already on its way."
He pressed a button on a console at the head of the table, and a television screen glowed to life, showing the cone-shaped satellite in a plastic bag, making its descent. It was being cradled by mechanical hands.
"The central core of this circular building," Stone said, "contains elevators and service units, plumbing, wiring, that sort of thing. That is where you see the capsule now. It will be deposited shortly in a maximum sterilization assembly on the lowest level."
He went on to explain that he had brought back two other surprises from Piedmont. The screen shifted to show Peter Jackson, lying on a litter, with intravenous lines running into both arms.
"This man apparently survived the night. He was the one walking around when the planes flew over, and he was still alive this morning."
"What's his status now?"
"Uncertain," Stone said. "He is unconscious, and he was vomiting blood earlier today. We've started intravenous dextrose to keep him fed and hydrated until we can get down to the bottom."
Stone flicked a button, and the screen showed the baby. It was howling, strapped down to a tiny bed. An intravenous bottle was running into a vein in the scalp.
"This little fellow also survived last night," Stone said. "So we brought him along. We couldn't really leave him, since a Directive 712 was being called. The town is now destroyed by a nuclear blast. Besides, he and Jackson are living clues, which may help us unravel this mess."
Then, for the benefit of Hall and Levitt, the two men disclosed what they had seen and learned at Piedmont. They reviewed the findings of rapid death, the bizarre suicides, the clotted arteries, and the lack of bleeding. Hall listened in astonishment. Levitt sat, shaking his head. When they were through, Stone said, "Questions?"
"None that won't keep," Levitt said.
"Then let's get started," Stone said. They began at a door, which said in plain white letters, "To Level 2. It was an innocuous, straightforward, almost mundane sign. Hall had expected something more, perhaps a stern guard with a machine gun, or a sentry to check passes. But there was nothing. And he noticed that no one had badges or clearance cards of any kind. He mentioned this to Stone. "Yes," Stone said, "we decided against badges early on. They are easily contaminated and difficult to sterilize. Usually, they are plastic and high-heat sterilization melts them." The four men passed through the door, which clanked shut heavily and sealed with a hissing sound. It was airtight. Hall faced a tiled room, empty except for a hamper marked clothing. He unzipped his jumpsuit and dropped it into the hamper. There was a brief flash of light as it was incinerated. Then, looking back, he saw that on the door through which he had come was a sign. "Return to Level 1 is not possible through this access." He shrugged. The other men were already moving through the second door, marked simply Exit. He followed them and stepped into clouds of steam. The odor was peculiar, a faint woodsy smell that he guessed was scented disinfectant. He sat down on a bench and relaxed, allowing the steam to envelop him. It was easy enough to understand the purpose of the steam room. The heat opened the pores, and the steam would be inhaled into the lungs. The four men waited, saying little, until their bodies were coated with a sheen of moisture, and then walked into the next room. Levitt said to Hall,
"Oh, what do you think of this?"
"It's like a goddamn Roman bath," Hall said. The next room contained a shallow tub. "Immerse feet only. And a shower. Do not swallow shower solution. Avoid undue exposure to eyes and mucous membranes." It was all very intimidating. He tried to guess what the solutions were by smell, but failed. The shower was slippery, though, which meant it was alkaline. He asked Levin about this, and Levitt said the solution was alpha-chlorophen at pH 7.7. Levitt said that, whenever possible, acidic and alkaline solutions were alternated.
"When you think about it," Levitt said, "we faced up to quite a planning problem here. How to disinfect the human body, one of the dirtiest things in the known universe, without killing the person at the same time. Interesting." He wandered off. Dripping wet from the shower, Hall looked around for a towel but found none. He entered the next room and blowers turned on from the ceiling in a rush of hot air. From the sides of the room, UV lights clicked on, bathing the room in an intense purple light. He stood there until a buzzer sounded and the dryers turned off. His skin tingled slightly as he entered the last room, which contained clothing. They were not jumpsuits, but rather like surgical uniforms. Light yellow, a loose-fitting top with a V-neck and short sleeves, elastic banded pants, low rubber-soled shoes, quite comfortable, like ballet slippers. The cloth was soft, some kind of synthetic. He dressed and stepped with the others through a door marked Exit to Level 2. He entered the elevator and waited as it descended. Hall emerged to find himself in a corridor. The walls here were painted yellow, not red, as they had been on Level 1. The people wore yellow uniforms. A nurse by the elevator said, "The time is 2:47 p.m., gentlemen. You may continue your descent in 1 hour." They went to a small room marked Interim Confinement. It contained a half-dozen couches with plastic disposable covers over them. Stone said, "Better relax. Sleep if you can. We'll need all the rest we can get before Level 5. He walked over to Hall. "How did you find the decontamination procedure?" "Interesting," Hall said. "You could sell it to the Swedes and make a fortune. But somehow I expected something more rigorous."
Just wait, Stone said. It gets tougher as you go. Physicals on levels 3 and 4. Afterward, there'll be a brief conference. Then Stone lay down on one of the couches and fell instantly asleep. It was a trick he had learned years before, when he had been conducting experiments around the clock. He learned to squeeze in an hour here, 2 hours there. He found it useful. The second decontamination procedure was similar to the first. Hall's yellow clothing, though he had worn it just an hour, was incinerated.
"Isn't that rather wasteful?"
he asked Burton. Burton shrugged.
"Oh, it was paper."
"Paper? That? Cloth?"
Burton shook his head.
"Not cloth.
Paper. New process." They stepped into the first total immersion pool. Instructions on the wall told Hall to keep his eyes open underwater. Total immersion, he soon discovered, was guaranteed by the simple device of making the connection between the first room and the second, an underwater passage. Swimming through, he felt a slight burning of his eyes, but nothing bad. The second room contained a row of 6 boxes, glass-walled, looking rather like telephone booths. Hall approached one and saw a sign that said, "Enter and close both eyes. Hold arms slightly away from body and stand with feet 1 foot apart. Do not open eyes until buzzer sounds. Blindness may result from exposure to long-wave radiation." He followed the directions and felt a kind of cold heat on his body. It lasted perhaps 5 minutes, and then he heard the buzzer and opened his eyes. His body was dry. He followed the others to a corridor, consisting of 4 showers. Walking down the corridor, he passed beneath each shower in turn. At the end, he found blowers, which dried him, and then clothing. This time the clothing was white. They dressed and took the elevator down to level 3. There were 4 nurses waiting for them. One took Hall to an examining room. It turned out to be a 2-hour physical examination, given not by a machine, but by a blank-faced, thorough young man. Hall was annoyed and thought to himself that he preferred the machine. The doctor did everything, including a complete history, birth, education, travel, family history, past hospitalizations and illnesses, and an equally complete physical. Hall became angry. It was all so damned unnecessary. But the doctor shrugged and kept saying, "It's routine." After 2 hours, he rejoined the others and proceeded to level 4. 4 total immersion baths, 3 sequences of ultraviolet and infrared light, 2 of ultrasonic vibrations, and then something quite astonishing at the end. A steel-walled cubicle with a helmet on a peg. The sign said, "This is an ultraflash apparatus. To protect head and facial hair, place metal helmet securely on head, then press button below." Hall had never heard of ultraflash, and he followed directions, not knowing what to expect. He placed the helmet over his head, then pressed the button. There was a single, brief, dazzling burst of white light, followed by a wave of heat that filled the cubicle. He felt a moment of pain so swift he hardly recognized it until it was over. Cautiously, he removed the helmet and looked at his body. His skin was covered with a fine, white ash. And then he realized that the ash was his skin, or had been. The machine had burned away the outer epithelial layers. He proceeded to a shower and washed the ash off. When he finally reached the dressing room, he found green uniforms. Another physical. This time they wanted samples of everything. Sputum, oral epithelium, blood, urine, stool. He submitted passively to the tests, examinations, questions. He was tired and was beginning to feel disoriented. The repetitions, the new experiences, the colors on the walls, the same bland, artificial light. Finally, he was brought back to Stone and the others. Stone said, "We have 6 hours on this level. That's protocol. Waiting while they do the lab tests on us. So we might as well sleep. Down the corridor are rooms marked with your names. Further down is the cafeteria. We'll meet there in 5 hours for a conference, right?" Hall found his room marked with a plastic door tag. He entered, surprised to find it quite large. He had been expecting something the size of a Pullman cubicle, but this was bigger and better furnished. There was a bed, a chair, a small desk, and a computer console with built-in TV set. He was curious about the computer, but also very tired. He lay down in the bed and fell asleep quickly. Burton could not sleep. He lay in his bed on level 4 and stared at the ceiling, thinking. He could not get the image of that town out of his mind, or those bodies, lying in the street without bleeding. Burton was not a hematologist, but his work had involved some blood studies. He knew the variety of bacteria had effects on blood. His own research with Staphylococcus, for example, had shown that this organism produced two enzymes that altered blood. One was the so-called exotoxin, which destroyed skin and dissolved red cells. Another was a coagulase, which coated the bacteria with protein to inhibit destruction by white cells. So it was possible that bacteria could alter blood, and it could do it many different ways. Strep produced an enzyme, streptokinase, that dissolved coagulated plasma. Clostridia and pneumococci produced a variety of hemolysins that destroyed red cells. Malaria and amoebae also destroyed red cells by digesting them as food. Other parasites did the same thing. So it was possible. But it didn't help them in finding out how the scoop organism worked. Burton tried to recall the sequence for blood clotting. He remembered that it operated like a kind of waterfall. One enzyme was set off and activated, which acted on a second enzyme, which acted on a third, the third on a fourth, and so on, down through 12 or 13 steps until finally blood clotted. And vaguely he remembered the rest, the details, all the intermediate steps, the necessary enzymes, the metals, ions, local factors. It was horribly complex. He shook his head and tried to sleep. Levitt, the clinical microbiologist, was thinking through the steps in isolation and identification of the causative organism. He had been over it before. He was one of the original founders of the group, one of the men who developed the life analysis protocol. But now, on the verge of putting that plan into effect, he had doubts. 2 years before, sitting around after lunch, talking speculatively, it had all seemed wonderful. It had been an amusing intellectual game then, a kind of abstract test of wits. But now, faced with a real agent that caused real and bizarre death, he wondered whether all their plans would prove to be so effective and so complete as they once thought. The first steps were simple enough. They would examine the capsule minutely and culture everything onto growth media. They would be hoping like hell to come up with an organism that they could work with, experiment on, and identify. And after that, attempt to find out how it attacked. There was already the suggestion that it killed by clotting the blood. If that turned out to be the case, they had a good start. But if not, they might waste valuable time following it up. The example of cholera came to mind. For centuries, men had known that cholera was a fatal disease, and that it caused severe diarrhea, sometimes producing as much as 30 quarts of fluid a day. Men knew this, but they somehow assumed that the lethal effects of the disease were unrelated to the diarrhea. They searched for something else, an antidote, a drug, a way to kill the organism. It was not until modern times that cholera was recognized as a disease that killed through dehydration primarily. If he could replace a victim's water losses rapidly, he would survive the infection without other drugs or treatment. Cure the symptoms, cure the disease. But Levitt wondered about the scoop organism. Could they cure the disease by treating the blood clotting? Or was the clotting secondary to some more serious disorder? There was also another concern, a nagging fear that had bothered him since the earliest planning stages of wildfire. In those early meetings, Levitt had argued that the wildfire team might be committing extraterrestrial murder. Levitt had pointed out that all men, no matter how scientifically objective, had several built-in biases when discussing life. One was the assumption that complex life was larger than simple life. It was certainly true on the Earth. As organisms became more intelligent, they grew larger, passing from the single-cell stage to multicellular creatures, and then to larger animals with differentiated cells working in groups called organs. On Earth, the trend had been toward larger and more complex animals. But this might not be true elsewhere in the universe. In other places, life might progress in the opposite direction, toward smaller and smaller forms. Just as modern human technology had learned to make things smaller, perhaps highly advanced evolutionary pressures led to smaller life forms. There were distinct advantages to smaller forms: less consumption of raw materials, cheaper spaceflight, fewer feeding problems. Perhaps the most intelligent life form on a distant planet was no larger than a flea, perhaps no larger than a bacterium. In that case, the wildfire project might be committed to destroying a highly developed life form without ever realizing what it was doing. This concept was not unique to Levitt. It had been proposed by Merton at Harvard and by Chalmers at Oxford. Chalmers, a man with a keen sense of humor, had used the example of a man looking down on a microscope slide and seeing the bacteria formed into the words, "Take us to your leader." Everyone thought Chalmers' idea highly amusing. Yet Levitt could not get it out of his mind, because it just might turn out to be true. Before he fell asleep, Stone thought about the conference coming up, and the business of the meteorite. He wondered what Nagy would say, or Karp, if they knew about the meteorite. Probably, he thought, it would drive them insane. Probably, it will drive us all insane. And then he slept. Delta Sector was the designation of three rooms on Level 1 that contained all communications facilities for the wildfire installation. All intercom and visual circuits between levels were routed through there, as were cables for telephone and teletype from the outside. The trunk lines to the library and the central storage unit were also regulated by Delta Sector. In essence, it functioned as a giant switchboard, fully computerized. The three rooms of Delta Sector were quiet. All that could be heard was the soft hum of spinning tape drums and the muted clicking of relays. Only one person worked here, a single man sitting at a console, surrounded by the blinking lights of the computer. There was no real reason for the man to be there. He performed no necessary function. The computers were self-regulating, constructed to run check patterns through their circuits every 12 minutes. The computers shut down automatically if there was an abnormal reading. According to protocol, the man was required to monitor MCN communications, which were signaled by the ringing of a bell on the teleprinter. When the bell rang, he notified the 5-level command centers that the transmission was received. He was also required to report any computer dysfunction to Level 1 command, should that unlikely event occur. Day 3. Wildfire. 12. The conference.
"Time to wake up, sir."
Mark Hall opened his eyes. The room was lit with a steady, pale, fluorescent light. He blinked and rolled over on his stomach.
"Time to wake up, sir."
It was a beautiful female voice, soft and seductive. He sat up in bed and looked around the room. He was alone. "Hello?"
"Time to wake up, sir."
"Who are you?"
"Time to wake up, sir."
He reached over and pushed a button on the nightstand by his bed. A light went off. He waited for the voice again, but it did not speak. It was, he thought, a hell of an effective way to wake a man up. As he slipped into his clothes, he wondered how it worked. It was not a simple tape, because it worked as a response of some sort.
The message was repeated only when Hall spoke. To test his theory, he pushed the nightstand button again. The voice said softly,
"Do you wish something, sir?"
"I'd like to know your name, please."
"Will that be all, sir?"
"Yes, I believe so."
"Will that be all, sir?"
He waited. The light clicked off. He slipped into his shoes and was about to leave when a male voice said, "This is the answering service supervisor, Dr. Hall. I wish you would treat the project more seriously." Hall laughed. So the voice responded to comments and taped his replies. It was a clever system. "Sorry," he said. "I wasn't sure how the thing worked. The voice is quite luscious." "The voice," said the supervisor heavily, "belongs to Miss Gladys Stevens, who is 63 years old. She lives in Omaha and makes her living taping messages for SAC crews and other voice reminder systems."
"Oh," Hall said.
He left the room and walked down the corridor to the cafeteria. As he walked, he began to understand why submarine designers had been called in to plan wildfire. Without his wristwatch, he had no idea of the time, or even whether it was night or day. He found himself wondering whether the cafeteria would be crowded, wondering whether it was dinner time or breakfast time. As it turned out, the cafeteria was almost deserted. Levitt was there. He said the others were in the conference room. He pushed a glass of dark brown liquid over to Hall and suggested he have breakfast.
"What's this?" Hall said. 42.5 nutrient. It has everything needed to sustain the average 70-kilogram man for 18 hours.
Hall drank the liquid, which was syrupy and artificially flavored to taste like orange juice. It was a strange sensation, drinking brown orange juice, but not bad after the initial shock. Levitt explained that it had been developed for the astronauts and that it contained everything except air-soluble vitamins.
"For that, you need this pill," he said.
Hall swallowed the pill, then got himself a cup of coffee from a dispenser in the corner.
"Any sugar?" Levitt shook his head. "No sugar anywhere here. Nothing that might provide a bacterial growth medium. From now on, we're all on high-protein diets. We'll make all the sugar we need from the protein breakdown, but we won't be getting any sugar into the gut. Quite the opposite."
He reached into his pocket.
"Oh, no." "Yes," Levitt said.
He gave him a small capsule, sealed in aluminum foil.
"No," Hall said. "Everyone else has them. Broad spectrum. Stop by your room and insert it before you go into the final decontamination procedures."
"I don't mind dunking myself in all those foul baths," Hall said. "I don't mind being irradiated, but I'll be goddamned."
"The idea," Levitt said, "is that you be as nearly sterile as possible on level 5. We've sterilized your skin and mucous membranes of the respiratory tract as best we can. But we haven't done a thing about the GI tract yet."
"Yes," Hall said, "but suppositories?"
"You'll get used to it. We're all taking them for the first 4 days. Not, of course, that they'll do any good," he said, with a familiar wry, pessimistic look on his face. He stood. "Let's go to the conference room. Stone wants to talk about carp."
"Who?"
"Rudolf Karp."
Rudolf Karp was a Hungarian-born biochemist who came to the United States from England in 1951. He obtained a position at the University of Michigan and worked steadily and quietly for 5 years. Then, at the suggestion of colleagues at the Ann Arbor Observatory, Karp began to investigate meteorites with the intent of determining whether they harbored life or showed evidence of having done so in the past. He took the proposal quite seriously and worked with diligence, writing no papers on the subject until the early 1960s, when Calvin and Vaughan and Nagy and others were writing explosive papers on similar subjects. The arguments and counterarguments were complex, but boiled down to a simple substrate. Whenever a worker would announce that he had found a fossil, or a proteinaceous hydrocarbon, or other indication of life within a meteorite, the critics would claim sloppy lab technique and contamination with Earth-origin matter and organisms. Karp, with his careful, slow techniques, was determined to end the arguments once and for all. He announced that he had taken great pains to avoid contamination. Each meteorite he examined had been washed in 12 solutions, including peroxide, iodine, hypertonic saline, and dilute acids. It was then exposed to intense ultraviolet light for a period of 2 days. Finally, it was submerged in a germicidal solution and placed in a germ-free, sterile isolation chamber. Further work was done within the chamber. Karp, upon breaking open his meteorites, was able to isolate bacteria. He found that they were ring-shaped organisms, rather like a tiny, undulating inner tube, and he found they could grow and multiply. He claimed that, while they were essentially similar to earthly bacteria in structure, being based upon proteins, carbohydrates, and lipids, they had no cell nucleus, and therefore their manner of propagation was a mystery. Karp presented his information in his usual quiet, unsensational manner, and hoped for a good reception. He did not receive one. Instead, he was laughed down by the 7th Conference of Astrophysics and Geophysics, meeting in London in 1961. He became discouraged and set his work with meteorites aside. The organisms were later destroyed in an accidental laboratory explosion on the night of June 27, 1963. Karp's experience was almost identical to that of Nagy and the others. Scientists in the 1960s were not willing to entertain notions of life existing in meteorites. All evidence presented was discounted, dismissed, and ignored. A handful of people in a dozen countries remained intrigued, however. One of them was Jeremy Stone. Another was Peter Leavitt. It was Leavitt who, some years before, had formulated the Rule of 48. The Rule of 48 was intended as a humorous reminder to scientists and referred to the massive literature collected in the late 1940s and the 1950s concerning the human chromosome number. For years it was stated that men had 48 chromosomes in their cells. There were pictures to prove it, and any number of careful studies. In 1953, a group of American researchers announced to the world that the human chromosome number was 46. Once more, there were pictures to prove it, and studies to confirm it. But these researchers also went back to re-examine the old pictures and the old studies, and found only 46 chromosomes, not 48. Leavitt's Rule of 48 said simply, "All scientists are blind." And Leavitt had invoked his rule when he saw the reception Karp and others received. Leavitt went over the reports and the papers and found no reason to reject the meteorite studies out of hand. Many of the experiments were careful, well-reasoned, and compelling. He remembered this when he and the other wildfire planners drew up the study known as the Vector 3. Along with the Toxic 5, it formed one of the firm theoretical bases for wildfire. The Vector 3 was a report that considered a crucial question. If a bacterium invaded the Earth, causing a new disease, where would that bacterium come from? After consultation with astronomers and evolutionary theories, the wildfire group concluded that bacteria could come from three sources. The first was the most obvious, an organism from another planet or galaxy, which had the protection to survive the extremes of temperature and vacuum that existed in space. There was no doubt that organisms could survive. There was, for instance, a class of bacteria known as thermophilic that thrived on extreme heat, multiplying enthusiastically in temperatures as high as 70 degrees Celsius. Further, it was known that bacteria had been recovered from Egyptian tombs, where they had been sealed for thousands of years. These bacteria were still viable. The secret lay in the bacteria's ability to form spores, molding a hard, calcific shell around themselves. This shell enabled the organism to survive freezing or boiling and, if necessary, thousands of years without food.
It combined all the advantages of a spacesuit with those of suspended animation. There was no doubt that a spore could travel through space. But was another planet or galaxy the most likely source of contamination for the Earth? Here, the answer was no. The most likely source was the closest source, the Earth itself. The report suggested that bacteria could have left the surface of the Earth eons ago, when life was just beginning to emerge from the oceans and the hot, baked continents. Such bacteria would depart before the fishes, before the primitive mammals, long before the first ape man. The bacteria would head up into the air and slowly ascend until they were literally in space. Once there, they might evolve into unusual forms, perhaps even learning to derive energy for life directly from the sun, instead of requiring food as an energy source. These organisms might also be capable of direct conversion of energy to matter. Levitt himself suggested the analogy of the upper atmosphere and the depths of the sea as equally inhospitable environments, but equally viable. In the deepest, blackest regions of the oceans, where oxygenation was poor and where light never reached, life forms were known to exist in abundance. Why not also in the far reaches of the atmosphere? True, oxygen was scarce. True, food hardly existed. But if creatures could live miles beneath the surface, why could they not also live 5 miles above it? And if there were organisms out there, and if they had departed from the baking crust of the Earth long before the first men appeared, then they would be foreign to man. No immunity, no adaptation, no antibodies would have been developed. They would be primitive aliens to modern man, in the same way that the shark, a primitive fish unchanged for 100 million years, was alien and dangerous to modern man, invading the oceans for the first time. The third source of contamination, the third of the vectors, was at the same time the most likely and the most troublesome. This was contemporary Earth organisms taken into space by inadequately sterilized spacecraft. Once in space, the organisms would be exposed to harsh radiation, weightlessness, and other environmental forces that might exert a mutagenic effect, altering the organisms, so that when they came down, they would be different. Take up a harmless bacteria, such as the organism that causes pimples or sore throats, and bring it back in a new form, virulent and unexpected. It might do anything. It might show a preference for the aqueous humor of the inner eye and invade the eyeball. It might thrive on the acid secretions of the stomach. It might multiply on the small currents of electricity afforded by the human brain itself, drive men mad. This whole idea of mutated bacteria seemed far-fetched and unlikely to the wildfire people. It is ironic that this should be the case, particularly in view of what happened to the Andromeda strain. But the wildfire team staunchly ignored both the evidence of their own experience, that bacteria mutate rapidly and radically, and the evidence of the biosatellite tests, in which a series of Earth forms were sent into space and later recovered. Biosatellite 2 contained, among other things, several species of bacteria. It was later reported that the bacteria had reproduced at a rate of 20 to 30 times normal. The reasons were still unclear, but the results unequivocal. Space could affect reproduction and growth. And yet no one in Wildfire paid attention to this fact, until it was too late. Stone reviewed the information quickly, then handed each of them a cardboard file. "These files," he said, "contain a transcript of autoclock records of the entire flight of Scoop 7. Our purpose in reviewing the transcript is to determine, if possible, what happened to the satellite while it was in orbit." Hall said, "Something happened to it?" Levitt explained,
"The satellite was scheduled for a 6-day orbit. since the probability of collecting organisms is proportional to time in orbit. After launch, it was in stable orbit. Then, on the second day, it went out of orbit. Hall nodded.
Start,
Stone said,
with the first page.
Hall opened his file.
Autoclock transcript. Project Scoop 7. T minus time. 2 hours, 1 minute, 5 seconds. Vandenberg launch pad, block 9. Scoop, mission control, reports systems check on schedule. 1 hour, 39 minutes, 52 seconds. Scoop MC, holds for fuel check, reported from ground control. Stop clock, real-time loss, 12 minutes. 1 hour, 39 minutes, 52 seconds. Count resumed, clock corrected. 41 minutes, 12 seconds. Scoop MC, holds 20 seconds for launch pad. Block 9 check. Clock not stopped for built-in hold. 30 minutes. Gantry removed. 24 minutes. Final craft systems check. 19 minutes. Final capsule systems check. 13 minutes. Final systems checks read as negative. 7 minutes, 12 seconds. Cable decoupling. 1 minute, 7 seconds. Stat link decoupling. 5 seconds. Ignition. 4 seconds. Launchpad block 9 clears all systems. 0 seconds. Core clamps released. Launch. T plus time. 6 seconds. Stable. Speed 6 FPS. Smooth EV approach. 9 seconds. Tracking reported. 11 seconds. Tracking confirmed. 27 seconds. Capsule monitors at G1.9. Equipment check clear. 1 minute. Launchpad Block 9 clears rocket and capsule systems for orbit. No point in dwelling on this, Stone said. It's the record of a perfect launch. There's nothing here, in fact, nothing for the next 96 hours of flight to indicate any difficulty on board the spacecraft. Now, turn to page 10.
They all turned.
Track transcript continued. Scoop 7. 96 hours, 10 minutes, 12 seconds. Orbital check stable as reported by Grand Bahama Station. 96 hours, 34 minutes, 19 seconds. Orbital check stable as reported by Sydney. 96 hours, 47 minutes, 34 seconds. Orbital check stable as reported by Vandenberg. 97 hours, 4 minutes, 12 seconds. Orbital check stable, but system malfunction reported by Kennedy Station. 97 hours, 5 minutes, 18 seconds. Malfunction confirmed. 97 hours, 7 minutes, 22 seconds. Malfunction confirmed by Grand Bahama. Computer reports orbital instability. 97 hours, 34 minutes, 54 seconds. Sydney reports orbital instability. 97 hours, 39 minutes, 2 seconds. Vandenberg computations indicate orbital decay. 98 hours, 27 minutes, 14 seconds. Vandenberg scoop mission control orders radio re-entry. 99 hours, 12 minutes, 56 seconds. Re-entry code transmitted. 99 hours, 13 minutes, 13 seconds. Houston reports initiation of re-entry. Stabilized flight path.
What about voice communication during the critical period?
There were link-ups between Sydney, Kennedy, and Grand Bahama, all routed through Houston. Houston had the big computer as well, but in this instance, Houston was just helping out. All decisions came from Scoop, Mission Control, and Vandenberg. We have the voice communication at the back of the file. It's quite revealing.
Transcript of voice communications, Scoop, Mission Control, Vandenberg, AFB. Hours 96:59 to 97:39. This is a classified transcript. It has not been abridged or edited. 96 hours, 59 minutes.
Hello, Kennedy. This is Scoop Mission Control. At the end of 96 hours of flight time, we have stable orbits from all stations. Do you confirm?
97 hours.
I think we do, Scoop. Our check is going through now. Hold this line open for a few minutes, fellows.
97 hours, 3 minutes, 31 seconds.
Hello, Scoop, MC. This is Kennedy. We have a stable orbit confirmation for you on the last pass-by. Sorry about the delay, but there is an instrument snag somewhere here. 97 hours, 3 minutes, 34 seconds. Kennedy, please clarify. Is your snag on the ground or aloft? 97 hours, 3 minutes.